Okay, let's start today with a specific artifact. I want you to visualize a photograph.
Right.
It's grainy, it's amateur, shot in really bad lighting inside a New York City subway car. This is from around 2013.
Oh, I think I know the one you're talking about.
And sitting right there on one of those plastic benches, looking very casual in a beanie, is Sergey Brin, the co-founder of Google.
It's a pretty famous image in tech circles, yeah.
It is. But what makes it so striking isn't just that it's a picture of a billionaire taking the train, it's what he's wearing.
Google Glass.
He has the silver band wrapped around his forehead, and there's a tiny prism just hovering over his right eye. It's the prototype of Google Glass. And in the photo, he is looking directly at the person taking the picture.
Which creates this immediate, almost visceral tension. You look at that image and you just feel, I don't know, unsettled.
Unsettled is exactly the right word. It feels like a violation somehow, even though he's just sitting there. And that feeling is what we really need to unpack today. We're not just talking about smart glasses. We're talking about how we process reality itself. I want to try a thought experiment. Let's put you, the listener, right there on that bench next to Sergey Brin.
Okay, set the scene.
You're sitting next to him. The subway's rattling along. He looks over at you. You look at him. You know that thing on his face has a camera. You know it's connected to the internet. The premise of our deep dive today is that how you interpret that split second, whether you see a cool gadget, a business opportunity, or, a threat, it all depends entirely on which language you choose to speak.
And we should be clear, when we say language, we don't mean English or French or German. We mean disciplinary framework.
Exactly.
We have this tendency to think we're all seeing the same reality, but we're not. We see the reality our vocabulary lets us see.
Right. So let's audit these languages.
Yeah.
If I'm sitting next to Brin and I decide to view the world through, say, the lens of STEM science, technology, engineering, what am I actually seeing?
You're seeing a descriptive analysis of physical reality. That's it. If you're an engineer in that subway car, the value of that moment is defined by material properties.
So you're not worried about privacy at all.
No, not at all. You're asking questions like, what's the mass of that titanium frame? How is the battery handling heat dissipation? How is that little prism refracting photons into his retina?
So the whole vocabulary is mass, volume, velocity, connectivity.
Precisely. It
Yeah.
is purely objective. In the language of STEM, the camera isn't a surveillance tool, it's just a sensor. It captures light and converts it into digital signals. There's no judgment in physics. A photon is just a photon.
Okay, but let's be honest. Most of us aren't thinking about photons on the subway. So let's switch languages. Let's say I'm an economist. I'm sitting there looking at this prototype. I don't care about the battery life. What do I care about?
You care about the transaction.
Yeah.
The reality shifts from being physical to transactional. Those glasses are no longer an assembly of plastic and silicon. They are a unit of cost and a potential unit of profit.
So I'm thinking about margins.
You're thinking about incentives. You're asking, what was the R&D burn rate to build that? If we discount the retail price by 10%, does the demand curve shift enough to increase the total profit?
People become
The
variables.
human element enters the picture, but yeah, only as a variable.
Yeah.
Brin is a supplier. The other passengers, they're demand signals.
It's cold, but it's rational. It's the language of utility. Now let's go to the third one, which I think is the default for a lot of people when they see new tech, the
Yeah.
legal perspective.
This is the language of boundaries. If a lawyer is sitting on that bench, they aren't looking at photons or profit margins. They're looking at permissibility.
They're asking, is Brin even allowed to do this?
Correct. The vocabulary completely changes. It becomes compliance, statute, liability, regulation. The lawyer looks at that camera and asks, is this compliant with New York State surveillance laws?
Right. Does the facial recognition software violate any biometric data statutes?
Does the NYPD have the authority to tell them to turn it off? That's the mindset.
And usually with brand new tech, the answer is yeah, it's legal.
Usually, yes.
Yeah.
And that's the trap. Because you can measure the weight of the glasses with STEM, you can calculate the potential profit with economics, and you can confirm that, yes, it is legal to take photos in a public space with law.
But none of those languages explain why that photo makes you feel so creepy.
Exactly. The creepiness isn't illegal and it's not unprofitable. It's something else entirely.
It's ethical
It's
friction.
ethical friction. And this brings us to the fourth language, which is really the core of our discussion today.
Ethics.
And I want to be very precise here. We often treat ethics as just, feelings or opinions.
Sure.
But in this context, ethics is a technical language. It has its own vocabulary, its own logic, and its own rules, just like engineering does.
So if physics studies matter and economics studies value exchange, what does ethics study?
Ethics is the study of intrinsic goods. It is the evaluation of human value. So when we switch to this channel, we stop talking about efficiency or compliance. We start using words like freedom, privacy, dignity, autonomy, and intrusion.
And the question changes from, can I do this, to should I do this?
It's even more specific than that, I think. The ethicist on that train asks, at what point does Sergey's freedom to record interfere with my privacy?
Ah, so that implies a collision. It's not just that he's doing something, it's that his action is crashing into my reality.
That is the definition of an ethical dilemma. It's rarely a choice between good and evil. That's easy. Real ethics is about the collision of two valid positive values.
So what are the two goods here?
Well, on one side you have Brin's autonomy, his ability to augment his reality, to access information, to document his life. That's a form of freedom. We generally like freedom.
And on the other side?
The bystander's privacy. The right to not be indexed. The right to, you know, a certain kind of anonymity.
But hold on, I have to play devil's advocate here.
Please do.
We are on the NYC subway. It is literally the most public place on earth. If you are standing in Times Square or riding the 4 train, haven't you basically waived your claim to privacy? You're in public. You're there to be seen.
That is the classic counterargument, and it's a good one. If the setting is public, does the value of privacy just degrade to zero? If I have no expectation of privacy, then maybe Brin's freedom encounters no resistance. There's no collision.
Right. If I pick my nose on the train, I can't sue someone for seeing me do it.
True. But there's a massive, and I mean massive, difference between being seen and being processed.
What do you mean by that?
We rely on something sociologists call civil inattention. When you ride the subway, people see you, but they don't watch you. They don't study you. And crucially, they forget you.
The decay of human memory.
Exactly. Our memory is fallible, and that fallibility creates a protective buffer. You have privacy through obscurity, but the machine does not forget. The machine indexes. The Google Glass removes that natural decay of memory. It makes the observation permanent and searchable.
So the tool itself changes the ethical weight of the action.
Drastically. It's not just, I saw you, it's, I have captured you. And ethically, capture violates the intrinsic good of dignity in a way that just a casual observation doesn't.
Which is why the legal language always lags behind.
Yes. The law says, you're in public, photos are legal. The ethical language says, wait a minute, the permanence of this data fundamentally changes the nature of the interaction.
This leads us to a definition that I think is really essential here. You're describing ethics not as a list of rules, like don't do this, but as more of a weighing mechanism.
Ethics is evaluation, literally the act of attributing value. Think of it like an algorithm. To do ethics is to run a calculation. You identify the variables, the values at play, and you assign them a weight based on the context.
Okay, so let's try to run that code. We're on the subway. Variable A is Sergey's freedom. Variable B is the bystander's privacy.
And maybe there's a variable C, Social Security. I mean, what if facial recognition allows the police to identify a violent criminal instantly? The utility of the technology goes way up.
But the cost is the intrusion on everybody else.
Right. So the ethical act is the math, is the increase in autonomy, the ability to know who is around you, greater than the decrease in dignity, the feeling of being scanned.
It sounds incredibly cold when you put it that way. Yeah. We're talking about human dignity like it's a number in a spreadsheet.
It feels cold. I know. But if we want to build a society or an AI that aligns with our values, we have to be able to articulate those values as distinct variables. We can't just say it feels wrong. We have to say, in this specific context, the degradation of privacy outweighs the utility of information access.
But to run that algorithm, you need to know what to put in it. We need a list of the values that actually count. And the reading for this deep dive made a really interesting distinction between instrumental values and intrinsic values.
This is the litmus test for what counts in ethics. It's fundamental.
So break it down for us.
An instrumental value is something we want because it gets us something else.
Mm-hmm.
The classic example is money.
Ah, the money fallacy.
Correct. We have this obsession with money, but nobody actually wants money. You can't eat a $20 bill. You can't live inside a credit card. We want money solely because it is an instrument to acquire other things.
Security, comfort, status, freedom.
Exactly. Money is a tool. It's not the destination. So money itself is not an ethical value. It's just a mechanism. If we are building our ethical algorithm, we don't optimize for money. We optimize for the things money buys.
Which would be the intrinsic values.
Yes, the things we desire for their own sake. When you ask, why do you want this? And the final answer is simply, because it is good. You have found an intrinsic value.
So what's on that list?
Happiness is the big one. Autonomy, the power to govern yourself, dignity, fairness, equality, authenticity, and unmaleficence.
Unmaleficence, that's a mouthful.
It just means the absence of harm, do no harm.
Okay, so let's go back to Sergey Brin on the train. He's smiling in the photo. He seems to be having a great time.
He does.
So if the glasses make him happy, if he derives joy from this technology, then happiness is a variable we have to put into our equation.
It is, absolutely. And this is where it gets really uncomfortable for people. If happiness is an intrinsic good, and autonomy is an intrinsic good, we have to weigh Brin's happiness against the bystander's privacy.
We aren't comparing good versus evil.
No, we are comparing good versus good.
And that's the proficiency of ethics, isn't it? It's easy to spot the villain.
Mm.
It's much harder to tell someone that they're good, their fun, their tech is actually less valuable than someone else's good, like their privacy.
That is the graduate level insight. The difficulty of the subway scenario isn't that Brin is doing something malicious. It's that he is exercising a form of freedom that corrodes another form of value.
Let me throw a wrench in the gears here.
Please.
We've been assuming Brin is just, you know, playing with a toy. But what if he isn't? What if he's using an app that helps him remember names because he has early onset memory loss? Or what if the glasses are providing real-time captions because he's hard of hearing?
Now you've changed the weights on the variables.
Right. Suddenly, his autonomy isn't just fun, it's basic functioning.
This is the dual-use dilemma that's inherent in all AI. The same camera that invades your privacy can also give independence to a disabled person. If facial recognition allows a prosopagnosic person, someone with face blindness, to recognize their own children, that is a massive ethical positive.
So does that positive utility justify the loss of privacy for the rest of the people in the car?
A utilitarian would say yes. If it helps more people than it hurts, or if the help is profound enough, it's worth the cost. But a deontologist, someone focused on rights, would say, no, I have a right not to be scanned, regardless of how useful it is to you.
That feels like the gridlock we're living in right now. We have these amazing tools that offer incredible utility, safety, connection, health. But the price tag is this constant erosion of the private self.
And we are making that trade-off passively. We do it every time we accept a terms of service or install a smart doorbell. We are implicitly saying, I will trade 10% of my privacy for 20% more convenience.
I want to circle back to one of the values you mentioned, authenticity. How does surveillance impact that? Because if I know I'm being recorded, I act differently.
You perform.
I perform. I fix my posture. I don't pick my nose. I smile more.
This is the panopticon effect. If you are constantly observed, you internalize the gaze of the observer. You lose the shadows, and shadows are where autonomy often lives. If I am constantly being evaluated, am I truly free? Or am I just an actor reading a script that I think society wants me to read?
That connects back to dignity. Is it really dignified to be a permanent actor?
I would argue it isn't. If authenticity is an intrinsic good, something we want for itself, then a surveillance state is ethically impoverished, even if it is safer. We might be richer in data, but we are poorer in human experience.
It's a haunting thought. We could build a perfect, safe, efficient world that just feels hollow.
That is the risk. We are building the algorithm of our culture right now. Every new device adjusts the weights.
This brings us to the final provocation. We promised a difficult question to chew on.
We did.
We've established that ethics is the act of evaluating and weighing these intrinsic goods. We know that in a world of limited resources, you can't maximize every value at the same time. You can't have total freedom and total safety.
These are zero-sum trades in many architectures, yes.
So here is the question for you, the listener. I want you to imagine you are the architect. You're writing the ethical algorithm for the next generation of society. You have to choose a prime directive. You can only maximize one of two intrinsic goods.
You have to choose where the bias of the entire system lies.
Option A, the maximization of personal privacy. This means protecting the individual from the gaze of others. It prioritizes solitude, the right to be forgotten, and the sanctuary of the mind.
But you have to understand the cost. If you choose this, you accept a world with more friction. You accept that crimes might be harder to solve. You accept less connection and less convenient data.
Or option B, the maximization of social well-being and connection.
This path, prioritizes transparency. It maximizes information flow. It allows us to know everything about everyone, instant verification, total context, high trust, because nothing is hidden.
But the cost is total exposure. The cost is that secrets are impossible. The cost is that you are always on stage forever.
You cannot have both. The technology forces a divergence.
So which is the higher intrinsic good? If you had to program the future, do you save the secret self or do you build the hive mind?
It's the ultimate evaluation, and there is no answer key.
That is the work of the ethicist. And whether you like it or not, that is the work you are doing every time you put on the glasses or take them off.
We're all writing the code.
That's it for this deep dive. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the next one.